Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. This is your host, Catholic Answers apologist, Trent Horn. As I said on Monday, I'm on vacation this week. Got to restore the batteries. I thought I would take a vacation over Christmas. Just didn't quite happen because I am an awful workaholic sometimes. So I figured with President's Day, why not take a week off, spend some time with family? But I didn't want to neglect you, my fair listener. So I have provided for you an interview that I shared recently with Tim Staples on how to explain the Catholic faith to non-Christians. Part one is up on Monday. If you missed that, go check it out. But here now is part two of my interview with Mr. Tim Staples. Let's look at some more common ones we'll just see from those who aren't religious or identify as atheists. I mean, here's one. If God is love, they may not believe God exists, but saying if God is love, why does the church have so many rules that keep people from doing what they want? Contraception, same-sex behavior, you got to go to Mass on Sunday. Yes. If God is love, why does he care about so many rules?
Exactly. You know, you hit on this earlier when we were talking about religion. If you think about basketball, right? Mm-hmm. What was it that made, to me, the greatest basketball player that's ever picked up a basketball is Michael Jordan, my humble opinion. But watching him play basketball, what was it that made him so great? If he would have just taken the ball, elbowed somebody in the nose, and then dunked the ball, breaking all the rules, that would not have been beautiful. It wouldn't have been the magic that is Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. But it's the rules of the game that in one sense constrict that actually enabled him to be the great basketball player that he is. See, everything we see, whether it's, you mentioned football, we could talk about baseball, basketball, but everything has structure. Everything in nature has structure. There are rules. We talk about natural law or even laws of nature. There are rules to everything that we see, and it's keeping it within the lines that really enables there to be beauty, truth as well as goodness. So God created us, Trent, you know, and we have to help people understand this. God created us. He gave us a nature.
And so I think this is important for atheists who object to some of church teaching.
Right.
And this, you can help us understand a bit more this idea of natural law. Because I think many will see, especially if they come in contact with Protestant and Protestant fundamentalists, well, the rules are just what's written here in this book. It doesn't matter if they don't make sense. If they're written in the book, you got to obey them. That can seem arbitrary from their perspective. But what you're saying is what's revealed in, for example, scripture and then what we rationally come to, like Thomas does in the Summa, comes from this idea of a natural law that God made.
That's right. We are created in the image and likeness of God. And what does that mean? We, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, we have the ability to participate in the eternal law of God, which is God himself. Because God is ordered, right? Mm-hmm. God is the eternal reason. He creates us ordered. Look around at the creation. Anybody that says that the creation is not ordered needs to open up a science book,
right,
and take a biology textbook and see how wonderfully and beautifully ordered the creation is. This gives us a hint about who God is, a smidgen of a hint here,
right,
that God made us ordered. There's a reason why we're made the way that we are. Well, if natural law then is our participation in the eternal law of God, we can know something about our own natures, our purpose, why we are made. Look, Trent, God created us with an intellect, an intellect to know, a will to choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the ultimate choice is to choose love. So we're made to know, we're made to love. And ultimately, the highest knowledge and the highest love is God himself. We're made to know and to love God, right? It's a beautiful thing. And mind you, we're not using a Bible to come to this conclusion.
Right.
This is just by using our reason. Well, one of the beautiful things about natural law is we can take a look at our bodies, our natures, and we can see that we have purpose. Look at the sexual act and examine it. See what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
See the strictures that God has placed there, not in order to, you know, keep us bound, but so that we can be Michael Jordan, right?
Right.
We can express ourselves fully in accordance with the way we're made. And so the rules are a good thing. This is something we really have to raise up a younger generation that is somewhat rebellious against, ultimately the anarchy that has presented itself over the last 40, 50 years in our country. We need to rebel against that and say, no, we need to get back to this idea of order and that, gosh, the sexual act, for example, is made for something. Mm-hmm. It's made to join one man and one woman together in a permanent relationship until death do us part. It's made for the procreation of children. And so if you're using that great gift of sexuality outside of those strictures, that's like Michael Jordan punching a guy in the nose, stepping on him, and dunking the basketball. No, that's ugly.
And you're saying we can look at our very bodies and see what, especially, and I think it would make sense, a lot of atheists will say that the church is teaching on sexual morality is one of their biggest beefs. Is that surprising that that's the one of all that they're going to pick?
Gee, absolutely not. Of course, you know, I think,
well, and also not even just atheists, but even many Protestants, former Catholics.
Yeah, well, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas in his commentary on Ephesians, and it's in chapter 5 where St. Paul gives a list of mortal sins, and if you do these things, you're not going to heaven. Mm-hmm. Thomas says that St. Paul uses unequivocal language for a reason, because from the beginning of time, man has always done a couple of things. Number one, he wants to say things aren't really sinful that are. Mm-hmm. And number two, he wants to say there's not consequences for those acts. And so Paul, in unequivocal terms, mm-hmm. says, if you do these things that are sinful,
right,
you will not inherit eternal life. And mm-hmm. yet, Trent, what do we have? We have theologies that are created that say, if you're born again, if you do those sins, you're still going to go to heaven.
Right.
Right? And, you know, that's from a quote-unquote Christian perspective. Of course, outside of the church and in the world, we're going to have that tendency to want to be able to say, like Frank Sinatra, I did it my way.
Right.
Who, you can't tell me. Nobody's going to tell me what I can and can't do. And the sad thing is, though, Trent, is as we started this conversation, God created us. He knows us better than we do. He knows what we're made for, and he's given us the ability to know it too. Mm-hmm. We can come to know what the sexual act is for, and when we understand it and we act in alignment with God's will, that's where real joy, real love, and real fulfillment comes from. Look at the world mm-hmm. and those that are living, you know, without stricture, without, you know, I'm free to do whatever I want. We have a world today in the United States, we may have a lot of money, but we have such abject misery mm-hmm. with divorce and abortion and you name it. Now with the, you know, gender mutilation that are going on, all in the name of freedom. That's
right.
Not freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It's slavery. Mm-hmm. Mankind, that is men, I'm using the generic term. All the humans out there are being reduced again and again to the lowest common denomination. The lowest common denominator, because we've lost that sense of who we are mm-hmm. as human beings created in the image and likeness of God.
Well, I think one thing an atheist may fire back at this point, especially when it comes to the teachings of sexual morality, it's going to be this. And how would you respond to it? Isn't it hypocritical for a bunch of celibate men in yes. Rome without life experience going around telling everybody else what to do? Shouldn't they practice what Jesus and Pope Francis
yes.
have said, which is, you know, who am I to judge? Don't judge yes. other people.
Yes. You know, Trent, the Matthew 7:1, judge not, is probably one of the most misused verses in the entire Bible.
Some people make it their Bible.
Yes. that's about the only verse they know. Don't judge me. And really, if you take a look at that passage in context and couple it with 1 Corinthians 4:3-6, where you really get a biblical sense of judging and what that means. Jesus in Matthew 7 is saying, don't be a hypocrite. Mm-hmm. You don't judge other people with a different judgment that you judge yourself with. You tell them, oh, no, you can't do that, and then you go and do it.
Because, of course, even people who say to us, you shouldn't judge, they're judgmental. They judge us, one,
that's
and then
right.
they'll say a child molester is wrong, for example,
that's
with
right.
a clear conscience.
Absolutely.
Where, of course, if you secretly molest children, but you try to write it off. In fact, I was reading a disturbing report online about the dark parts of the internet where child pedophiles and molesters get together and talk.
Right.
And there's two groups. There's the ones that enjoy causing children pain.
Yes.
And then there's the other group who say they're just child lovers. They would never try to hurt. And so the child lovers say, we're not like the ones who cause pain. Those people are terrible. They're disgusting. But that's a clear case of judge not lest you be judged.
That's
saying,
right.
Okay, you're judging these molesters, yes. but you yourself are one.
It really is amazing. The this gets back to what we said earlier. We have to help people to slow down and think about what it is that they are saying. Look, Jesus says don't be a hypocrite in Matthew 7. He's not saying don't judge because he says if you remove the log from your own eye, you'll see clearly to be able to take the speck.
That's why you and I have a clear conscience to say both of those child molesters are wrong because we're not doing that. So you're just saying it would apply to a whole host of other things.
Sure, sure. And St. Paul, though, I think makes a very important distinction in 1 Corinthians 4, 3 through 6, when he says to the Corinthians, it is a very small matter for me to be judged by you or any man's judgment. He says, I don't even judge my own self. I have nothing on my conscience. In other words, there's no sin on my conscience that I'm aware of, but I am not thereby justified. The one who will judge me is the Lord. Therefore, judge not until such time when the Lord comes, and then each man will have his reward from God. So Jesus is saying, don't be a hypocrite. You judge consistently in accordance with right reason. Paul is saying you don't judge at all when it comes to the motives of the heart.
Because only God can see that.
Only God can see the heart. But of course, you have to judge actions. In fact, Jesus himself in John 7:24 says, judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. Jesus commands us to judge. And as you know, Trent, it's part of the spiritual works of mercy. In fact, two of the six spiritual works of mercy are to admonish the sinner and educate the ignorant. Both of those involved making judgments about a person's state of being. If they're in ignorance, hey, I need to educate them. If they're in sin, I need to admonish them. Well, guess what? I'm judging all over the place, but I'm not judging their motives. I'm not saying they're going to hell. I'm saying, hey, objectively, what you're doing here is wrong. And that's what we ought to do as human beings.
And so even, quote unquote, celibate old men in Rome are able to judge actions because we have, all of us have the ability to reason, even if we aren't personally engaged in an activity. We're judging.
Absolutely. And even that celibate Jesus can make pretty good judgments about us. You're right. You know, and I think the celibacy, I know that's not really your question, but celibacy is such a great gift in the church.
But I think a lot of people who are atheists, this is a good thing to dive into, find that to be a strange or bad thing that we say, oh, well, we hate sex. And so that's why we have to make all the priests at least celibate, but that's not the case.
It's not, because in a very real way, the priest is an eschatological sign for us. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder to you and I who are married that, hey, this guy over here has given that up, and it's a great gift that you and I have in our marriage with our wives is a wonderful thing. But he is a reminder to us that love transcend sex. Sex dies when we do. As Jesus says, there's no marriage in heaven. Sorry to our Mormon friends, but there's no marriage in heaven.
Right.
Sex dies when we do, but love is eternal. And so I think the celibate has a particularly powerful sort of platform. Mm-hmm. If you and I are in spiritual direction with our spiritual direction, saying, oh, Father, I'm struggling with, you know, a temptation. Oh, really? Really? You have a wife. Here I am, a celibate. Tell me about your temptation.
Right.
I mean, he can challenge us, can't he, to see the deeper truth. The Mother Teresa and the Pope St. John Paul the Great has a perspective that is so needed in our sexually crazed culture to show us what love is.
Let's look then at a last category of objections many atheists will bring up against the Catholic Church. And I think that's usually just trying to bring out the quote-unquote skeletons in the closet.
Right.
The idea that how can you say the Catholic Church is good, is a force for good in the world, when it's been involved in so many quote-unquote scandals in history? What about, and the biggest ones probably an atheist will throw out would be the Crusades, the Inquisition, And then more recently, the sex abuse scandals. I mean, what should Catholics do to respond when these are just kind of just thrown up in their face? Not out of an honest sense of inquiry, but just it's kind of a smoke screen or a dirty tactic.
You know, there's a couple of ways to approach it, Trent. What I find, I do try to often, and I've done this on airplanes. I'm thinking of one case in particular where I had a nice long conversation with a college professor on this topic. Mm-hmm. And I always like to point out, let's take the Crusades. That when Pope Urban II called the First Crusade in 1095, think about that, 1095. This had been after 450 years of Muslim incursion. Think of this. Muhammad was born in 570. He had his alleged revelation in 610, died in 632. Within 100 years of Muhammad's death in 632, just to 732, his followers had taken all of Palestine, all of North Africa. They swept through North Africa, through the Straits of Gibraltar, all the way through Spain, halfway through France, and were launching assaults into Eastern Europe as well. In 100 years, the Pope was the only moral force on this earth that could stop this. Well, we know that Charles Martel and his Christian forces in 732 at the Battle of Toulouse stopped what was just, you know, the Muslims overrunning the world. But it would be another 300 years of battling, you know, hundreds of years fighting to get lands back. I mean, and really being slaughtered, Christian women being taken into slavery and so forth. Okay, so 400 years of this. And the Pope is the only moral force in the earth that can call for a crusade to stop this. And how does he become the bad guy, Trent?
So you're saying it's a misunderstanding then to think that the Crusades is just a war to attack these peaceful Muslim people when it's actually defensive against those who are attacking in the first place.
And I mean, we have to bring that out. Now, of course, there were bad things that happened in the Crusades, and we don't dismiss that. We don't take it lightly. John Paul, in fact, you know, asked for forgiveness for some of the things that happened in the Crusades. Bad things happen in wars. In every war, bad things are going to happen. We acknowledge that, and we do penance for that, as the popes called those involved to do penance for that. But I think to use the Crusades in the way that they're used today is really wrongheaded. When it comes to the Inquisition, you know, I have a book at home by Benjamin Netanyahu's father, who was a scholar, and he wrote a very lengthy book. He's Jewish, obviously, on the Inquisition. And in that book, Benjamin Netanyahu Sr. makes the point that the Inquisition for its day was actually mild. There are cases documented where people were taken to secular courts and they would blaspheme. Why? So that they could be sent to the Inquisition, because the Inquisition was so known for its fairness.
Right.
You know, if you take just the Spanish Inquisition alone, of course, there was in France and elsewhere, but just Spanish Inquisition alone, there were only between 2,000 or 3,000 people put to death by the Inquisition over a period of roughly 500 years. Mm-hmm. For the day, that was incredibly lenient. Now, unfortunately, the Inquisition has been taken and turned into a monster similar to the Crusades. But what we need to emphasize here is we acknowledge that bad things happen with the Inquisition. Even though it was better than anything in its day, we hold ourselves to a higher
standard.
But
is this a case that we're applying our current perspectives on how the state should function backwards in time to a completely different era?
You nailed it. You nailed it right there. And that really, in fairness, if you're going to look at history, you have to take those things into account. But at the same time, Trent, it's important for us to acknowledge that bad things did happen. We call people to repentance for the bad things that did happen. But really, let's get back to the real matter at hand. And that is this. In the church, we have to remember, we do not have a collection of nothing but saints.
Right.
I mean, the church is not a museum of saints. It's a hospital for sinners. Of course, we have sinners in the church. We're all sinners, and sinners are going to sin.
Right.
That's why Jesus gave us this hospital that we call the church. And so we shouldn't be so surprised when we have people sinning in the church. That's always going to happen. But what about, Trent, the fact that the greatest men and women that have ever walked the planet for the last 2,000 years just happened to be Catholic? Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. As a matter of history, you can look at any field, whether it's science or doctors, if you want to go to philosophy or theology or whatever, lawyers, right? We have our St. Thomas More.
Right.
We have the greatest men and women that have ever lived in the church. So here's what I like to put to people. All right, yes, we have sinners in the church that have done bad things, but they're not sinning, and the bad things don't happen because of the church.
Right.
It happens because people don't live up to what the teachings of the church teach.
So if there was no church, the sins would still be there.
They would be there, and they'd be worse, I argue. But the point is, why would you judge a church because of the things that people do that don't live up to it? I mean, that would be like saying, oh, this medicine here this doctor gave me, it's terrible. It didn't do anything for me. Well, did you take the medicine? Well, no. Okay, you can't judge the medicine if you didn't even take it. Look at the people who took the medicine. Look at the people like mm-hmm. the St. Thomas Mores, and we could go down the litany mm-hmm. of saints who actually took the medicine, and it empowered them to be, you know, some of the greatest human beings.
And this would apply to the most recent scandal, probably, than the sex abuse scandal. Just using these same principles when this is thrown up to, is there anything else that, for that in particular, maybe should be added, but just this general approach?
Yeah, I think that is the approach, but I'd also toss out, you know, Dr. Philip Jenkins, our friend who's been on Catholic Answers Live a couple of times, who's not Catholic. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book in 2001, the updated version was 2001, Priests and Pedophiles, The Anatomy of a Crisis, where he did extensive research. He's a professor of history and religious studies at Penn State, and again, not a Catholic. And he brings out in that book that there were tremendous exaggerations in the media mm-hmm. when it comes to the numbers of priests that were actually involved. We're talking about a small percentage of priests that were involved in something that is heinous.
Right.
The overwhelming majority of it was homosexual activity mm-hmm. and not pedophilia. According to Dr. Jenkins, mm-hmm. there were actually very few cases of actual pedophilia. Now, of course, one case is too many, Trent, of course.
Right.
And you know, it's absolutely abhorrent. It's the actual, just the core of evil for a priest to abuse a child. I mean, it's you know, beyond evil, mm-hmm. and we acknowledge that. But the bottom line is, we have to look at history honestly, because as I'll just give you this one stat, Dr. Jenkins points out there, you're talking about 1.7% of mm-hmm. priests that were involved in this sexual deviancy, whereas in Protestant circles, it was almost three times that. Mm. And yet they didn't get the airtime. And now Jenkins doesn't do this, but we could look at school teachers, we could look at lawyers, we could look at any other quote-unquote profession, and we have this problem. Why? Because the problem is a cultural problem. Mm-hmm. And folks want to make it out to be, oh, it's because of celibacy, it's because of the, you know, the evil Catholic Church. And that is simply not true. That is simply a lie. Mm-hmm. Some of the greatest men and women around this world happen to be priests and nuns, including in the United States.
Let's look now at one other aspect that atheists will bring up when it comes to the church, is the idea, has the church changed its teaching in order to accommodate the modern world and thus show that it's not infallible? And I think the biggest example people will throw up, it's interesting that there's strange bedfellows here, that there are atheists who say that the Catholic Church is not infallible because it's changed its teaching on religious liberty.
Right.
And then there are the radical traditionalists and sedevacantists who say, I'm Catholic, but the current church that says it's Catholic is not the Catholic Church because it's changed its teaching on religious liberty. So we have these two diametrically opposed groups that kind of argue the same thing. Has the church changed, thus nullifying its divine status on this teaching, and how do you address this charge?
Sure, yeah. In fact, I wrote a blog post, as you know, Trent, at Catholic.com on religious liberty, and oh my goodness, did we get a lot of comments. Right. And I got comments from both sides, just like you said, from the traditionalists on the Catholic end to folks on the atheist side all chiming in. But the bottom line is, no, the church has not changed our understanding when it comes to religious liberty. But what we have is two different perspectives essentially being presented by the church. Before 1870, when we had Christendom, we even had the Papal States for a while. That's all another topic. Mm-hmm. But we had Christendom. You had a struggle in the church with the idea of a Christian state. Mm-hmm. And how does a Christian state tolerate those that are not Christian,
right,
within its borders? What about, you know, their freedom to worship and so forth? And so you had that angle versus the angle at Vatican II 100 years later, where there is no longer a Christendom.
Right.
In fact, virtually all the nations of the world are atheistic, except for the Muslim countries where you have things that we don't really want to have.
Muslimdom.
That's right, Muslimdom, yes. And so Vatican II is coming at it from the perspective of the communist revolution, the persecution of Christians, mm-hmm. and how do we get back some semblance of religious liberty? And so when you have that 1850, a very different reality than 1965, you have documents that are emphasizing different things. Mm-hmm. The documents pre, you know, Vatican I, for example, and even somewhat later up into the early 1900s, where you still have that sort of defense of the idea of Christendom, they're coming at it from the perspective of, you know, the French Revolution, those who were, you know, casting off church authority, saying the church has nothing to say, casting off natural law, mm-hmm. and so forth. And the church is arguing, hey, the state has an obligation toward the true religion, which is the Catholic Church. And that's absolutely true. Individuals as well as the state mm-hmm. are bound, Pope St. John Paul the Great says in paragraph 73 of his great encyclical, The Gospel of Life, we all are bound to natural law as individuals and as nations. So a nation ultimately has an obligation to the true religion, mm-hmm. no doubt. Now, that doesn't mean you coerce. The church has never taught that. You don't coerce conversion,
right.
But the state has an obligation to ensure the true faith flourishes, all right? Well, what do you do then 100 years later where there is no Christian state, and now the states are all saying, you don't have a right to worship, you don't have a right to profess your faith.
Right.
Well, the church then comes at it from the perspective of natural law, mm-hmm. saying the individual has a right to worship God in accordance with his conscience. Mm-hmm. And where there's no Catholic state, that means worshiping in accordance with the light that they have mm-hmm. where they are. Now, that seems contradictory because, wait a minute, before you were saying the state has an obligation to the true religion, now you're saying the state has an obligation to allow people to worship in accordance with their conscience. That's a contradiction. No, it's not a contradiction whatsoever. It's simply coming at it from a different perspective. Ultimately, we would like to reestablish, we'd like to evangelize nations to where we could have Christian nations.
For example,
again.
The state could favor the true church,
sure.
but still allow those of different religions to worship. They just wouldn't Absolutely. Receive state favoritism.
Absolutely. But that's not a contradiction. Mm-hmm. Why would Vatican II emphasize that when there's no Christian nation that
right.
can implement it? Mm-hmm. Vatican II is trying to save Christians who, and you know what, Trent, in a sense, Vatican II was so prophetic here. Because in its doctrine on religious liberty, it's so prophetic. Because at the time of the writing, yeah, we had the problem with the communists and so forth persecuting Christians, but we were nowhere near where we are today. Mm-hmm. Where today, Trent, we have over 150 nations of the world that are actively persecuting Christians. Mm-hmm. This has never happened in the history of the world.
Right.
And that document on religious liberty is prophetic because it says, look, men and women need to stand up for their rights as human beings. We talked about it before with natural law. We can know, without a Bible, without a Catholic Church, we can know that I have an intellect that's ordered to know God and a will that is ordered to love him. And a state does not have the right to contradict my nature mm-hmm. and force me mm-hmm. to act contrary to that nature.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time together, but I think this is some great material. Where else would you recommend people learn about more of what you do? And for atheists who are interested in the Catholic Church, to learn more about her.
Yeah, you know, I think, Trent, bringing you on board here at Catholic Answers has kind of turned the ship in the right direction. We are emphasizing a lot more Christian apologetics as well as Catholic apologetics. And I think your book, Answering Atheism, is a great start when it comes to a book that really exhaustively answers the questions. You get through Answering Atheism, and you're pretty much going to deal with about every question you can imagine on the existence of God. Check out our website at Catholic.com. We've got a lot. You know, we at Catholic Answers a lot of times promote the stuff from Catholic Answers Press. And of course, you know, my book, your book, everybody's books and CD sets and so forth. I would encourage folks to get a hold of my DVD, Why Be Catholic, where I take you from no faith at all the way to the Catholic Church. But we also have a ton of stuff folks can download for free. Mm-hmm. Go to Catholic.com, click on the library tab, and you'll see tracks, you'll see all sorts of things. Go to the tracks, for example, and you can download these that answer tons of questions, especially when it comes to folks like our fundamentalist friends and Bible-believing Christians and so forth. But we've got really, I think, at Catholic.com an enormous amount of free stuff that folks can avail themselves to, and I hope they do.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for sharing this with us, and we'll pray that your good work continues to bless others and bring more souls to Christ and His church.
Thank you, Trent.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.